Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to do, as Elise said, just take a few minutes to sort of lay out a framework that cuts across the environments, the lifespan, and the generations. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the biology underpinning some of the ideas that I present, to show you sort of a flavor of some of the research. I'm obligated to tell you of any financial conflicts that I have, and I don't have any that I'm going to disclose for this presentation. As Elise has mentioned, we really do live in sort of multiple environments. And when we think about them, we break them out. I think of the chemical environment, the physical environment, biologic, psychosocial, the built environment, so on. And we know that both individually and collectively, in interacting among themselves, they influence health status or, alternatively, disease risks across the lifespan. And in the world of children's environmental health, we've spent a lot of time in the last 15 or 20 years learning about and reminding ourselves about how, because of windows of vulnerability and so on, children are particularly susceptible to certain exposures that don't have much influence, or at least not lasting influences on adults. So we've spent a lot of time thinking about the special vulnerability of children. What we're learning in more recent years is how those early life experiences actually influence disease risk, often much later in life, so that we really do want to begin to think across the lifespan. And I want to be quick to add in here that this does not mean that after childhood, nothing in the environment matters, of course, because environmental exposures throughout life also are a part of this story. And I think it's also useful, particularly since we're at a conference on public health, to think we're not only talking about the health of individuals, but we're also talking about the health of communities and populations. And so we can see signals that are often difficult to pick up at the individual level, but we can see disease patterns that emerge in communities or populations as a public health analysis that we may not see in an individual. And let me just give you a few examples of what I'm talking about. This isn't meant to be in any way exhaustive, but for example, there are many studies show now that air pollution is a risk factor for having a child of low birth weight. There are other environmental variables, too. What mother eats during pregnancy can influence birth weight of a child, maternal stress. And when you begin to put these together, add in some pollution with maternal stress and an inadequate diet, risks tend to sort of build up. And sometimes these things interact in ways that are even synergistic. A child that's born at low birth weight, particularly if he or she experiences rapid catch-up growth during the early part of childhood, is at higher risk for developing obesity by teenage years and on into early adulthood. Obesity, diabetes in midlife are themselves risk factors for dementia, cognitive decline, and dementia later in life. So you can begin to see how this story unfolds over the lifespan, where early life experiences influence what's going on throughout the life course. And now we're learning, particularly from some animal data and limited epidemiologic data, that we actually should be concerned about transgenerational effects, that sometimes these things are heritable across generations. Many of us are familiar with the story of, for example, diethylstilbestrol, where in utero exposure increased the risk of certain reproductive cancers in women who were exposed in the womb. We've a lot of data showing that DDT levels in women in adulthood. Very inconsistent evidence saying whether or not it was a risk factor for breast cancer. But then a few years ago, Barbara Cohn and her colleagues got hold of some serum that had been stored and drawn early in girls' and women's lives, and was able to show that if you looked at DDT exposures before the age of 14, those people who were more highly exposed during those early years were at far higher risk of breast cancer in that cohort. So again, the story is not just about diabetes and obesity and so on, but various kinds of cancer as well. I've also put in here, just to mention it briefly, that early life pesticide exposures in a large body of animal data are now showing us that the neurodegenerative impacts of that in later life are becoming quite clear. Parkinson-like symptoms and findings in the brains of laboratory animals exposed in development to pesticides showing up in adulthood, and some of the most recent, but the early epidemiologic data in humans, which were actually studies designed based on the animal data, are beginning to show a similar signal. And as Elise mentioned, we always want to keep in mind that the individual person is really embedded in these sort of the concentric circles of the family, the community, ecosystem, and society. And we can see evidence of not only interaction across those levels, but also even within the individual, at the cellular and subcellular level, you can see evidence of community variables, societal variables, and so on. So this really is an ecological framework that we're trying to lay out here. So let me just quickly run through those environments. The chemical environment, we know people are widely exposed to hundreds of chemicals. We know it from population-wide studies that are done by the Centers for Disease Control. This is the cover of the exposure report and on the CDC's website. The latest update for 2012, the new tables and showing what the levels are. We know that chemical exposures begin in the womb. Studies done of infant cord blood at the time of birth have been analyzed and show hundreds, literally hundreds of industrial chemicals in the baby's cord blood at the time of birth. President's cancer panel 3 years ago called this, babies are being born in this country pre-polluted. Again, because of the developmental vulnerabilities, it raises very, very urgent concerns about what the public health implications of this are. We've gathered together at the Collaborative on Health and the Environment a database in which we have over 200 diseases or disorders and the chemicals that have been associated with them in a database that's searchable either by chemical or by disease or disorder, with the strength of the evidence classified as strong, good, or inconsistent. So it's publicly available at healthandenvironment.org. The food environment is obviously very important, and I've illustrated here on this slide some of the all-too-common features of our food environment, beginning very early in life, obviously, and then setting lifelong dietary patterns, which often continue. Lots of refined sugars, up to, on average now, about 20% of calories from refined sugars in children in this country. Unhealthy fats, and notably what's missing here are the fruits and vegetables, which unhappily are just not commonly consumed in the amounts that are anywhere near the amounts that are recommended based on good scientific data. And we can say, just to sort of say some broad conclusions from the dietary data, that diets that contain unhealthy fats, saturated fats, trans fats, and a large excess of omega-6 fatty acids over omega-3s. Sixes and threes are both, they're polyunsaturated fatty acids, they're both essential fatty acids, we need to eat them. Our diet today has a large excess of omega-6s over omega-3s. And the lack of fruits and vegetables, as I mentioned, that collectively these increase the risks of virtually all the common diseases and disorders that are overwhelming our healthcare system now and creating enormous burdens on families and communities, virtually all of them. On the other hand, a diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables, healthy fats, increased amounts of omega-3s compared to 6s, low glycemic carbohydrates as opposed to highly refined and high glycemic carbohydrates, something that put together resembles what might be called a Mediterranean diet, actually reduces the risk of all those same diseases and disorders. And that comment is based on a whole lot of data that comes from observational studies as well as interventional studies. And I'm not going to go through these in detail. I just wanted to make the point that there actually are a lot of studies that are available showing this to be the case, with large effects on diabetes risk, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and so on. And I want to highlight here in particular Alzheimer's incidence and mortality, because this is just an emerging area of epidemiologic research. And the studies are far fewer than for the others, like diabetes and cardiovascular disease and so on. But the early studies are beginning to show that that this same kind of diet does actually reduce the risk of the onset of cognitive decline and dementia, or slow it in people in whom early signs are present. The extent to which that's the case, I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows yet. But this is getting a lot of attention now in some of the main medical and public health journals. And one other thing I wanted to mention in the interventional studies, because we are talking about across the lifespan here, is the third bullet. This is a small pilot study. I don't think it's ever been replicated, and it really wants to be badly. This was just published a couple of years ago, in which the investigators identified a small a group of women who they thought to be at risk for giving birth, preterm birth, at risk for preterm birth. They divided them in half, and one group they gave dietary advice to about weight control and fat limitations and so on. But the intervention group, they actually supplied the women with low glycemic carbohydrates, so that they actually brought them to their homes or gave them to them in the OB clinic at the time of their visits, and followed them through their pregnancy and birth. The preterm birth was less than half in the group that was given the low glycemic carbohydrates compared to the control group. If this is the case, if low glycemic carbs during pregnancy actually do really influence preterm birth risk anywhere near that degree, it really would be an enormously important public health thing to address. So I just wanted you to be aware of it. It's a pilot study. They agree it's a pilot study. It needs to be replicated. We should think about how to do that. And finally, the psychosocial environment. We know that socioeconomic status is a major determinant of disease risks. That's true for almost all of the major diseases. There are rare exceptions, but for almost all of them, socioeconomic status is a predictor for probably a variety of reasons. People of lower socioeconomic status probably in many cases are at increased risk of exposures in the environment that are detrimental to the health. Biologically, they're probably more susceptible to those exposures for a whole variety of reasons and mixtures of mechanisms, and less able to respond. So that combination of increased exposure, increased biologic vulnerability, less capacity to respond to them is sort of sets up a toxic triad that helps to explain why the socioeconomic status is so important. And let me just speed through just a few mechanisms to give you some flavor of actually how some of the biology has been worked out. So, for example, this whole notion of epigenetics is getting a whole lot of attention in the medical and scientific literature now. The idea that during development, what's important, well, we all know that our genetic background is one of the features that's important in terms of helping to figure out how things unfold during development. But that genetic, the manifestation of the genetic makeup can be influenced by environmental factors without actually causing gene mutations. The genes are not changed in terms of the nucleotide base pairs, as would be the case in mutations, but rather this is a process. Epigenetic mechanisms influence the expression of the genes, turn them on or off. Diet can do it. Chemicals can do it. Social stress can do it. That is established and imprinted during development with lifelong consequences. So this is a mechanism to keep your eye on as the studies continue to be published. Endocrine disruption, whereby chemicals can either mimic or interfere with the activity of signaling molecules, often part of the endocrine system. They can do it through other mechanisms as well. They can influence the metabolism of a hormone, the excretion of a hormone, the number of hormone receptors, and so on. But in the aggregate, endocrine disruption is another set of mechanisms by which development can be altered with lifelong consequences. We're paying a lot of attention, of course, to the chemical endocrine disruptors, but hormones can be altered by some of these other environmental features as well. Inflammation is a fundamental underlying mechanism that we find present in so many of the diseases and disorders, diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease. It's a hallmark of most kinds of cancer. We think of inflammation as the redness, swelling, and warmth of an injury that we might experience, but it's important to recognize that inflammation is also internally expressed. We can measure inflammatory markers in the blood. You can look in the blood, in the clots, in the arteries of people with coronary artery disease and see lots of inflammatory cells there. So inflammation is a central feature. Excessive oxidative stress is often a feature of many common diseases and disorders. We typically make what's called reactive oxygen species in our mitochondria as we metabolize our food to make energy in an oxygen-rich environment. That's part of our normal biology. But if we live in a world where we make excessive amounts of reactive oxygen species, and we don't counteract that with antioxidants, either because we're not producing them in our bodies or we're not consuming them in the fruits and vegetables and other sources of antioxidants in our diet, then we have an imbalance. We don't quench that excessive oxidative stress. So now we have excessive reactive oxidative species that then cause tissue damage, including DNA damage, and you see oxidative stress as being sort of a hallmark. Again, cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, and so on. And finally, insulin signaling. We think of insulin as the hormone that interferes, that helps us metabolize and keep our blood sugars under control. We helps glucose enter the cells to be metabolized and create energy, and it does that. It also has other influences. It helps keep our arteries healthy, flexible, and so on, as well as keeping our triglycerides in the normal range. And when we have disrupted insulin signaling, not only does blood sugar go up, but also our arteries get stiff and less compliant, and our triglycerides also go up. And it turns out that inflammation and oxidative stress not only promote each other, but together they also promote disrupted insulin signaling. And so this is a collection of mechanisms which we find actually at play when we're looking at diabetes, cardiovascular disease, many kinds of cancer, and cognitive decline and dementia. So we begin to see that although we have categories of disease and we give them names, there are opportunities here where interventions will allow us to begin to see how we could have a whole cascade of effects across a whole variety of diseases and disorders that we're commonly dealing with now. So this helps us sort out this complexity a little bit and look to what we might do. And at the risk of creating the traditional public health arrow salad, what I'm trying to do here is simply point out that all of these mechanisms I've talked about are being driven by various features of these environments, the food environment, the built environment, the chemical environment, the psychosocial environment, and so on. But that also provides us with opportunities to see how we can downregulate some of these things we don't want. And finally, I'll just point out that many of those features of the environment that I've just talked about are also not only driving diseases and disorders, but they're also driving climate change. We talk about air pollution or greenhouse gas, and we talk perhaps about low birth weight and cardiovascular risk, but look at the other end of this. So we begin to see how chronic diseases, patterns are also linked to the climate change story, and how can we then begin to identify interventions that will actually help across that range of impacts. So we do it at the personal level, and of course in medicine that's where people spend a lot of their time advising individual patients about how we should reduce this or do more of that, what we eat, don't smoke, avoiding chemicals and so on. All that's good stuff. Very important to do, but we also have to put it together with policy initiatives at the public health level that will begin to find interventions that are useful that will actually have population-wide, community-wide effects, looking at this through the public health lens. So I'll stop with that, except I want to finish by acknowledging that much of what I just presented was in a publication that we did a couple of years ago called Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging, and I want to acknowledge my co-authors, Jill Stein, Maria Valenti, and Ben Rohr. Thank you very much.